Welcome to the podcast service of the Massachusetts Climate Action Network. Visit us online at massclimateaction.net or friend us on Facebook.
Hi, and welcome to the Climate Minute, your source for insight and perspective on global warming news. My name's Ted McIntyre, and this show is for the week of May 9th, 2016. We're pleased to be joined by our frequent guest, the prolific commentator, Mr. D.R. Tucker. How you doing, D.R.?
Doing great. How you doing?
Great. Great to have you here. So, D.R., consequential things have been happening at several levels. Let's start out with a global one. This past April 22nd, which was Earth Day, a big event happened in the United Nations. And that big event at the United Nations was reflective of, I would say, an even bigger event that happened in Paris last December. So let's unpack that. Last December in Paris, we signed, the world signed the Paris Agreement to try and address climate change, highly celebrated at the time. But that agreement needs to be signed formally and ratified by 55 countries that represent something like 55% of the carbon emissions in the world. Or there's some arcane rule about when the agreement actually goes into effect. In this past Earth Day, there was a signing ceremony at the UN where a surprisingly large number of countries came to sign up to the agreement. Right? Did you see anything about that, dear?
Yes, there was a great report on climateprogress.org about that signing ceremony. A record 175 nations, according to Climate Progress, officially signed the agreement, the most to have signed in a UN agreement on an opening day. As you note, for the treaty to officially enter into force, according to Think Progress, at least 55 countries representing 55% of global emissions must both sign the treaty and approve it domestically. Now my understanding, and I think Brad Freeman and Desi Doyen have also discussed this on their Green News report, is that once it has been signed by that percentage, 55 countries, no country can pull out for 4 years, so that if the United States signs it, the United States can sign it in a way that does not require Senate, you know, the signing off on it. If the United States signs it and these other countries sign it, then no country can pull out until 2020, which means that, for example, if the United States, even if as a consequence of the upcoming presidential election, you have an opponent of the deal who becomes president, they can't pull out of it until 2020. And as been pointed out in a number of different circles, there are a lot of private entities who are going to comply with the Paris Agreement, and they will presumably use their muscle and their lobbying power to say, hey, let's stick with this.
Right. I think from what I read, the suggestion was that the large number of signers on the first day was a very good sign, and that because it meant that they would hit this 55-country threshold reasonably soon. The thing that I read somewhere said that if that 55-country threshold is hit while Obama is still in office, he can somehow sign the executive order that commits the United States to it, without, as you say, without the Senate. And so that it's really good if they can get to this threshold during the year 2016, or at least until January 20th, 2017, right? And that, and that gives Obama, basically commits the United States. So it's good. I mean, progress. So congratulations to everyone at the UN. There's a picture of John Kerry signing it with his granddaughter in his lap, which I guess is symbolic. Speaking of kids, there was a different thing that happened this past week that out in the state of Washington. Well, let me back up before we even go there. D.R., you and I have talked a bunch of times about a concept called the public trust doctrine, wherein the public trust doctrine says that the government inherently has a responsibility to take care of the environment, sort of put most simply, and that people can sue over that and force, and then the courts would force the government to take action. And in this mm-hmm. instance, this is in the state of Washington, there were some young kids who sued saying that they had suffered damage already because of the fact that the government had not addressed climate change and that they should have the right to sue the government to take action on climate, right? Did I get mm-hmm. that? So give me the background. What went on the state of Washington as opposed to the state of Oregon, right? The state of Washington.
In the state of Washington, King County Superior Court Judge Hollis Hill ruled on, I believe, April the 29th, that the plaintiffs in the lawsuit, basically ruled in favor of the plaintiffs in this lawsuit, challenging Washington State's alleged failure to take strong action to reduce carbon pollution. They ordered the Washington State Department of Ecology to create a strong emissions reduction rule by the end of 2016, and also to make a formal recommendation to the state legislature on how to implement legislation that will reduce emissions commensurate with what the science says has to be done in terms of reducing emissions. EcoWatch also noted that the Department of Ecology must consult with the plaintiffs, the minor plaintiffs, in advance of the recommendation.
Oh, really?
Now I know I've been kind of a Debbie Downer on these sorts of lawsuits, and let me sort of continue my tradition in that regard. The court has ordered them to make recommendations to the state legislature. Mm-hmm. And if you recall episode 5 of Years of Living Dangerously, the Showtime documentary from 2014, and in development subsequent to that, the legislature in Washington State seems rather, shall we say, disdainful of taking any action on reducing carbon pollution. There was an effort by, among others, Tom Steyer's organization to try to flip the state legislature in a way to have it more amenable to climate hawks, which didn't work, unfortunately. And so as a result, they will, as legally mandated, make those recommendations to the state legislature. But if the state legislature ignores those recommendations, then we might have something of a problem. And it's also very, very interesting to see how this will play out within the context of the other thing going on in Washington State 32, the carbon pricing initiative. And we shall see if...
This is up in Oregon, then.
That's also in Washington State.
Oh, okay.
Initiative 732 is also in Washington State. So it will be interesting to see. I don't know if the plaintiffs have weighed in on Initiative 732 and if they think that carbon pricing legislation, if passed by voter referendum, will drop emissions commensurate with what the science says. I'd be very, very interested in their take on it, as well as the attorney's take on it.
Well, I think that I hear you, and I think there's risk in everything, but the argument that we have made here, I've made, is, and I think you've made, is that these kinds of lawsuits that will force the government to take action mm-hmm. seem quixotic and silly initially, but you mm-hmm. keep plugging away and you start to win, and now we've got two wins, basically. You got one mm-hmm. in the state of Oregon a few weeks ago and this one in Washington. Mm-hmm. I think it's just something to keep an eye on, right?
Mm-hmm. It definitely is. I guess, you know, let's hope that it's not some sort of ironic result. If, for example, we have a situation where Initiative 732 passes, then it's legally challenged, as ballot initiatives often are, and then you have another court in Washington State striking down mm-hmm. Initiative 732. Mm-hmm. That would be awful.
Well, you just mentioned a gentleman named Steyer, who is a California entrepreneur, quite successful, right? I guess he'd be characterized as a billionaire kind of guy. Mm-hmm. He is also an extremely green guy and has been spending a lot of his money to support climate causes. Mm-hmm. So he's got a pretty big footprint out there in the climate world. Another guy with a pretty big footprint, maybe the Bigfoot of them all, is a guy named Bill McKibben, who has basically, we've talked many times about Bill McKibben, but he founded 350.org. He's mm-hmm. led all kinds of protests. Turns out that there is a one of these super PAC organizations. I forget. I don't want to say it's funded by the Koch brothers, but it's one of those mm-hmm. kind of things where there's dark money floating around, lots of money, and they have explicitly claim that they will be sort of outing the hypocrisy of environmentalists, in particular people like McKibben and Steyer, right? And they've yes. got some commercials running already showing, I don't know, silly things. I mean, have you seen anything about that? What's going on, and what should people be prepared to think when they see these sort of noxious commercials, I anticipate?
Yes, this is an outfit. It's a 501c4 known as America Rising Squared, which is an offshoot of America Rising. It was founded in America Rising was founded 3 years ago by a campaign, by a former aide to the Mitt Romney presidential campaign, which is rich with irony for those of us who remember the days when Mitt Romney gave a damn about this issue before he started making jokes about it. But in any event, America Rising Squared is the 501c4. They've decided to target Tom Steyer and Bill McKibben. They're apparently going to have trackers to follow them around and record them. Similar, you may remember that bit that Sean Hannity used to play on his show for years and years about the tracker who saw Al Gore getting into a car that supposedly wasn't a hybrid and that sort of thing.
Right.
They're going to make this big push on social media and have some sort of website that's going to be devoted to, trying to smear McKibben and Steyer. Kate Shepard of the Huffington Post had an interesting report where it's noted that the person who's running this specific operation is a fellow by the name of Brian Rogers, who in 2009 actually worked, strangely enough, for Al Gore's Alliance for Climate Protection. He had been prior to that an aide to John McCain when McCain was running for president and McCain was supporting cap and trade. After he left the Alliance for Climate Protection, he went back to supporting McCain. So one wonders, has a screw become loose in the man's head to do something like this, to go from trying to defend climate action, trying to support a political figure who at the time supported climate action, to now trying to rhetorically butcher two of the strongest advocates for climate action. It's very, very strange.
I guess the
dark world of political operatives. Basically.
Well, maybe that's the best way to say it. These guys, I mean, I don't know this gentleman, but it seems like there's a lot of mercenary types out there, and as long as you pay them, they'll do whatever needs to be done. Right? Mm-hmm. And you can't, just because these people work for a campaign doesn't mean they believe in it, right?
And the irony of this guy working for an outfit called America Rising, going after people who are trying to stop America's greenhouse gas emissions from rising.
So I guess the other the point I would say is that if and when you see this kind of toxic attacks on people like McKibben and Steyer, other green people, just take it with a grain of salt, right? Mm-hmm. It's a consciously manufactured marketing campaign by people who are very clever. They may be mercenaries, but that doesn't mean they're stupid, right? They want to find ways to go to do basically character assassination and to make a person, whatever personal hypocrisy is found, turn that into the issue instead of the issue of climate. And as you listen, prepare yourself for that kind of stuff, because that's what so those guys make their living.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the other interesting, one other interesting story, again, very packed couple of weeks. I heard a report that America now has its first climate refugees, and that there is a town in Louisiana, right on the coast of Louisiana, for which they've essentially given up on trying to save or bunker it in, and they're going to move those people someplace else. Are they going to allow those people, help those people move if they want, right?
Mm-hmm.
So have you seen that? Tell me, what's the lowdown there?
Yes, there was a great story in the New York Times about a program by the Department of Housing and Urban Development. In January, they announced that they would have grants totaling $1 billion to help communities adapt to climate change. And one of those grants is going to relocate people from the Isle de Jean Charles, or Jean Charles in Louisiana. and to help them move because their land is basically being so repeatedly flooded and their land will not survive rising sea levels. So it's time for them to move. It's a fascinating story because it brings up issues of people, you know, being concerned about whether they will be able to be accepted in other communities mm-hmm. if they move, people who don't want to leave the land they love. And also another subtext that I saw some bit of social media discussion on, the irony of a story about people being affected by climate change in Louisiana, and the fact that the New York Times made the reference to refugees. You may remember that controversy from the Hurricane Katrina, the post-Hurricane Katrina, as to whether the media should refer to people as refugees if they're United States citizens. Right. So it'll be interesting if the New York Times gets any heat for using the term refugees as opposed to using the term of people who have been displaced by climate change. So it's a fascinating story. This is going to be repeated. You know about how Florida, you'll have people who will be displaced and they'll have to be moved. People in Virginia who will be displaced and they'll have to be moved.
Well, that's the thing I heard is that there's something like $55 million to move several hundred people or something.
Right? Yes,
And it's like, okay, there's going to be millions of people in Pakistan, in Bangladesh, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. This is just the first hint, the first little flutter of angel wings as to what might come and how expensive it would be and how disruptive mm-hmm. it will be. You know, when as the seas slowly rise and people are forced to move out of where they've have lived for generations. I mean, it's really mm-hmm. A harbinger of scary things to come.
It is just you know, fascinating. We talk about when people come to this country, we think about, remember the controversy and how there's always these sorts of tensions that rise because people have trouble accepting newcomers. Mm-hmm. You know, when we think mm-hmm. about, you know, things like, you know, the Mariel boat lift in 1980, we think about, you know, refugees from Haiti coming in the early 1990s and how people get real nativist when that sort of stuff happens. How, you know, will we see more rising tensions as more people have to flee their countries and come to our country? And do people who have these sort of nativist reactions understand that if you don't do anything to curb carbon pollution, you'll have more and more people trying to flee to the United States? I mean, we're going to have, you know, we're going to have more and more people. It's going to be a repeat of the Irish immigration to the United States from the potato famine. Right. Think of potato famines and similar famines all over the world.
Right.
That's what's going to happen if we don't do anything.
No, I agree with you. I mean, we're going to put up a show in a few weeks talking about the interaction of sustainability and security. Right? I mean, mm-hmm. this is a huge issue. If you have millions of people, I mean, look at the Syrian thing. I mean, how disruptive politically, aside from the awful human suffering of the people being forced to move, just how mm-hmm. disruptive it is to the entire societies they're moving into. Right? It's mm-hmm. like, oh, my God. So, Deanna, I got one last story, which I think is right up your alley, since you're a media guy. Mm-hmm. You like to critique the media. So there's this guy who comes on TV typically when I'm cutting Z's late at night. I don't very often mm-hmm. see Jimmy Kimmel, but he's a one of these late night hosts. He has a, right now there's something gone viral, some sort of YouTube video that he has put up mm-hmm. about climate change. So tell me, what's the deal with the Jimmy Kimmel thing?
Yes, it's a segment that aired on May the 2nd, which has received at least 600,000 views. It was Jimmy Kimmel's response to a new documentary that's been made by a former aide to Rush Limbaugh, basically, you know, dredging up the climate gate issue from 2009 mm-hmm. and basically saying it's all a hoax and the, you know, Gore's corrupt and all the scientists are corrupt and all the usual, you know, BS. It's being promoted by Sarah Palin, who I guess is now a PR flack for this sort of documentary. And Kimmel was basically making the point that Palin should not substitute her own judgment for that of 97% of the climate science community. So in a bit that seems to have been inspired by John Oliver's 2014 bit about false balance in the climate issue in the mainstream media, he brought out several climate scientists. I think he produced this segment with conjunction with NASA, who are basically saying, you know, this is not made up. This is being done as a result of human activity. And I counted the phrase human activity 13 times, and that raised my eyebrows, because if you're watching this segment and you don't know about science, when you hear that climate change is being caused by human activity, you're going to think, well, what human activity? Right. Does combing your hair cause climate change? Does tying your shoes cause it? Does clipping your toenails cause it? You're not going to know. And I noticed that they never use the phrase burning fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. They use the phrase carbon pollution 30 seconds before the segment ends, but they never use the phrase burning fossil fuels. And I wondered about this because MediaMatters.org noted that this segment had more coverage of the climate change issue than ABC World News Tonight did in the entirety of 2015, or ABC This Week on Sunday mornings covered in the entirety of 2015. And with regard to that controversy, and with regard to an issue that the progressive radio host Nicole Sandler has made about the role ABC through the late Lunarage made in terms of moving the media to where they don't cover serious issues like climate change, I couldn't help speculating, was there any sort of pressure by ABC to not include footage of the climate scientists, presumably, as they must have, using the phrase burning fossil fuels? Was that phrase something that the scientists said, and was it edited out because of the fear of offending advertisers? And if so, you know, as I know this segment is getting a lot of praise, but it kind of diminishes the impact if you don't spell out specifically what the human activity is, because you know brushing lint off your pants doesn't cause the problem. That's a human activity. Cleaning your eyeglasses is a human activity, doesn't cause the problem. Right.
It almost sounds like
it doesn't cause the problem.
It almost sounds as if, yeah, when you say human activity, it means inherently human things, right? Walking, yes. Talking, breathing, being creates climate change. When it's so at that level, I agree with you. At the other level, I mean, Jimmy Kimmel is a comedian. He's trying to make people laugh, and the segment has some salty language in it. You gotta watch it. It's yes. Kind of a hoot, but
it goes to the point that the phrase human activity within the context of the climate change issue needs to be retired as a phrase. It is an amorphous phrase. It is, as they say in the legal community, void for vagueness. It means absolutely nothing. And you have to spell out what the specific
activity is.
You can't just say human activity, because again, what human activity?
Right,
seriously. Right. I mean, if I take out some tweezers and remove gray hairs from my head, does that cause the problem? Of course not. But that's a human activity. It has now become a stupid phrase that needs to be retired, and it should never be muttered by any climate scientist or climate activist ever again.
We will never say that phrase on this podcast again.
And you even hear it in the current political context. I'm not trying to take shots at anybody, but how many times have we heard people who there are people who are running and they use that phrase. They need to stop that too, because it's an amorphous, meaningless, void, and just sort of nonsense BS phrase. Spell out what the activity is, or else people are not going to know what the hell you're talking about.
Well, I guess, yeah, we got to leave it there. We will not say those words, sort of like Voldemort. We will not say them human activities ever again here. What we'll do is we'll put up links to most of the stuff that happens at our blog, which is a human activity as well, posting a blog. It's massclimateaction.net/blog. Please share. You can find us on Facebook. It's /massclimateaction. Please share us from there. There's a human activity that involves listening to this podcast on your smartphone using Stitcher or TuneIn Radio. I suppose at some level, if you're running your iPhone, you're going to ask, where's the energy for that coming from, right? So anyway, you can find us on iTunes. So we'll close the way we always close, by saying that because we recognize the necessity of personal accountability for our actions, because we accept responsibility for building a durable future, because we believe it is our patriotic duty. I was just going to say, our patriotic human activity, our patriotic duty as citizens to speak out. We must insist that the United States put a price on carbon. So thank you very much for being here, DR.
Well, you know, doesn't it say in the Declaration of Independence when in the course of human activity it becomes necessary?
Anyway, thanks to everyone for listening. We'll talk to you again next week. Bye-bye.
Thanks for being with us, and until next time.
Very cool.